Welcome, everybody. My name is Jennifer Cook. I'm director of the Africa program here at CSIS. And we're delighted to host today the governor of River State, Rotimi Amechi. And we're going to open up with remarks from the governor. And then we hope this will be interactive with plenty of question and answer. The governor came to office in October 2007. I think you all know that there were controversies surrounding his taking office, and maybe we'll hear a little bit about that and how that's affected the work that you're doing. Obviously, River State is a critical piece in the Niger Delta, where a crisis for many years has been going on in recent years, very much more intense and in some ways internationalized and affecting the region, affecting U.S. and international interests as well, in energy security, shut-ins of Nigerian oil, and so forth. I think we all know the crisis has long-standing roots, the marginalization of the Niger Delta by the federal government, but also local roots, successive governments in the Delta, unwilling, unable to deliver services to their citizens. And added to this now, more recently, a layer of criminality and something of an industry in small arms, hostage-taking, oil bunkering, and the like. We think this is a very important time in Washington. We have a new administration here. There's been a lot of uncertainty in Nigeria of how the U.S. engages, and partly that stems from uncertainty within Nigeria itself. The elections were fraught with problems. I think Nigeria has been seized with its internal problems in some ways, and I think the U.S. government has, over time, shown a certain willingness and eagerness to engage on the question of the Delta because our interests are affected, but has not really found the place to plug into that. And very much, I think, is looking to the local governments and to the federal government to set up a process into which we can engage. And I think that will be interesting to hear from you today as you talk about the challenges of your particular state, where you think the international community, the United States in particular, if that's true, can plug in to help support and get through the challenge. Couple of things I'd like to hear from you as well. One here is that in River State, and we've heard a little bit from you, very much an emphasis on law and order first and foremost, and different in some ways from the approach of other Delta states, which have tried perhaps to co-opt militants and work that way. And I thought you might talk about that model, how you see it compared to other states, and then the questions that I think have dogged the Delta for many years on accountability and transparency of government, the longer-term issues of infrastructure, education, and so forth. What your plan is on that and where you see that going. So, Governor, again, we're delighted to have you here and look forward to your comments and to the questions from the audience. Thanks.
I'm actually confused. In Nigeria, it's supposed to be about 7:15 in the evening, but I guess it must be afternoon here. So good afternoon, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. Let me thank you, Jennifer, for your wonderful introduction. You've taken virtually all areas that I'm supposed to cover. And I'm sure for you to do that, you must have a big knowledge of Niger Delta. And let me also thank you for the opportunity of having to address my friends and brothers and sisters who are here. I'm privileged to be the governor of a critical state in the world. Critical because we produce 60% of Nigerian gas, the only state that produces 60% of Nigerian gas, no other. And we produce about nearly 40% of Nigerian oil. So I'm sure that we're important in Nigeria, just as we're important in the international community. I begin with the question about my emergence as the governor of the state. I was trained at the University of Port Harcourt. The University of Port Harcourt is a university that belongs to the federal government in Port Harcourt. And one of those who trained me used to be a Marxist. So my interpretation of reality is based on the relationship between the rich and the poor, and who takes preeminence over the other. That will explain why I wasn't given the opportunity to be governor of the state when others were given the opportunity of being the governor of the state. And I say that because a state as rich as River State that gets about nearly between $200 to $300 million dollars per month, then you must know that a lot of people will be interested in who becomes the governor of the state. The implication, therefore, is that an unimportant person cannot just emerge. Somebody must push you through to emerge so that he can protect a lot of economic interests. And then suddenly from nowhere, this man that nobody knows in Nigeria, even though I was the chairman of the conference of Nigerian speakers of the state legislature, I wasn't part of the establishment per se properly. So nobody to protect me. And the quickest way you used to know those days to take you out of government is to accuse you of corruption. If you know me well, if you ask Nigerians, you can go and find out. They will tell you I'm among those who detest corruption. I try hard to make sure that the world knows that I don't like corruption and that I'm not particularly rich, and I don't want to be very rich. But so what they did was, okay, we don't want you. And then they came after me, locked me up for one night. My dear wife, I wonder how she was feeling that night. And then released me the next day, accusing me of corruption, accusing me of 20 billion naira. All my life as speaker, I've never seen more than 2 billion naira. Eight years. 8 years as speaker. So I wonder how I can see 20 billion naira and misappropriate 20 billion naira. Anyway, I won the primaries before that day. They didn't expect I would win. And I won with 6,000 votes. The second person just had hundreds of votes, not thousands of votes. Hundreds. And then a week after I won, I was arrested when I came for the primary election in Abuja. Unknown to me, I was going out of the hotel. Policemen with guns surrounded me. I said, poor civilian, call me, I will come. You don't need to come with guns to arrest me. They took me that night, kept me throughout the night till the next day. The next day they released me after I made statements that I don't know what they're talking about. Somehow I knew that larger interests was at play and I didn't want to fight. But my former boss felt we should try it. And I went to court. It took all interests were now on one side, including my former boss. After I went to court, after some months, they wanted me to withdraw, I refused. They all went on one side. We fought the High Court, Court of Appeal, and the Supreme Court ruled finally that this poor young man, won the primaries. And if he won the primary, nobody on earth outside God, by the law of Nigeria, had a right to remove his name. He should, by law, run his election. If you removed his name before the 14th of April, which was election day, you did not do it according to law. The implication, therefore, is that on that 14th of April, the person running the election was the man who won the primary, because the man you replaced him with is not known in the eyes of the law. The one that the law knows is the man who won the primary and he submitted his name. Secondly, you did not see that the first judgment at the High Court stated that you acted against the law by replacing his name without a court judgment. Even if you are right in replacing his name, you should have first and foremost gotten the Court of Appeal to set aside the judgment of the High Court. If he did not set aside the judgment of the High Court, the implication therefore means that even the man you replaced him with was not even a candidate by the High Court judgment. The other second implication is that even by the High Court judgment, this man was still the candidate in the eyes of the law. On 14th of April, the River State people were voting for this very man. But people were not seeing him, the law was seeing it. Secondly, by the Nigerian Constitution, there is no independent candidate. You vote for the party. If, therefore, on that 14th of April, everybody was voting for PDP, the implication in the eyes of the law is that whoever wins the PDP primary, whoever the court says is the candidate of PDP, becomes the governor. Therefore, they should swear this man in as the governor of River State. And I thank God that I was sworn in without the powers that be. and I thank God that the powers that be didn't support me, because I now have a lot of freedom to apply the resources of the state. Having explained that, I have a document here that has some bullet points, not really what I would want to write about. But I'm sure we don't have enough time, so I won't want to take you through what I refer to as the musings of a governor of a Niger Delta state. I was looking at the structure, I was looking at the historical background to the Niger Delta crisis. I tried to trace it to the colonial period when they set up the Willini Commission that had to identify the Niger Delta area as a special area of interest to both the British people and the federal government of Nigeria. And there was a need to invest in that area. And the issue, critical, that was important to both the British government and that of the federal government is the wealth of the people. The Niger Delta area, the environmental condition of the Niger Delta area is poor. The topography is very bad. What it would take a man in Lagos, the governor of Lagos, the amount of money it would take him to construct 124 kilometers of road, or what it would take me to do 120 kilometers of road, it will produce us four times that number of roads in Lagos. And in Kano, it will be like 10 times. I'll give you an instance. We are doing a ring road in Port Harcourt that will cost us $1 billion. One cable stay bridge, 12 bridges. You don't see that in Lagos. You don't see that in Kano. And to be able to do that kind of road in Port Harcourt, you have to excavate the soil 3 meters deep. And you have to do soil exchange. So you have to go somewhere else and look for better soil and transplant after you have excavated and removed the soil in Niger Delta. So it's a special area as recognized by both the federal government and the former colonial master. But that's not the beginning. That's not the only problem the Niger Delta people have. The greatest problem that the Niger Delta people have is the federal structure. Everybody here is happy because federalism operates. Federalism includes physical federalism. Let me own what God has given me on my soil, and let me pay tax to you. It's not so in Nigeria. So we have federalism, in quotes, in Nigeria, with a very big federal government. You can imagine a man who is very fat with tiny legs. What will happen? The legs will give in, is it not? That's what you should imagine that the Nigeria structure is like. That is first the basic problem. Nobody wants to give up. You see, the Nigerian crisis will begin to reduce the moment the federal government reduces in size, because people will stop struggling to be somebody at the federal level. But we have that crisis because this thing is too big. We can get a bite. Let's all head there, and everybody's heading there. And I tell them when I was a speaker, everybody's rushing to the federal capital just because of the oil in our backyard. And we're not allowed to see it, smell it, or touch it. And you can see, it began with first, under the British government, it was 100% derivation. What you produce is what you get. Then it came down after the war to 50%. Then came down to one point, they say, we want money after the war to develop the country, so you won't get anything, so zero. Complaints started after so many years. I think it was Babangida. Now gave it 3%, not to the state government, but to an agency called OMPADEC. No, 1.5% first. From 1.5%, it became 3% until Abacha, in the 1999 constitution, increased it to not less than, we want to emphasize that phrase, not less than 13%. Because our argument before the federal government is that you don't need a constitutional amendment to increase the current 13%. Since the constitution says not less than 13%, the implication, therefore, is that the president, either by law or by proclamation, can say, okay, from today I have increased this 13% to 50%. Even though the argument is that we should go for constitutional amendment, it doesn't require constitutional amendment. All it requires is an application of the law the way it is. So you can see the different interventionist agencies they have set put in place to rescue Niger Delta, and none has been able to rescue Niger Delta. I will tell you a funny story, how some claim the Niger Delta crisis started. I mean, when I say Niger Delta crisis, I'm talking about the security crisis, the shooting of guns and kidnapping of people. When Abacha wanted to perpetrate himself in office, they hired people all over the country to come and sing praise songs for him in Abuja. including people from Niger Delta. And when they got to Abuja, they saw something that looked like Washington, D.C. And these people have never traveled outside the country before. So they felt they were in a different world. They want to make sure that this was the capital of Nigeria, that Abacha did not go to another capital somewhere in America or somewhere in Europe to ask them to come for him to address them. So they asked, is this Nigeria? And they confirmed that it was Nigeria, that this was the capital of Nigeria. And they asked, if you build this kind of beautiful place, why can't you build it in the Niger Delta? They say, well, don't worry. We're making arrangements. It's in the pipelines. You know what it is to be in the pipelines? We are planning. So they assumed that that pipeline was the oil pipeline. So they began to break the oil pipeline to look for the So they've been looking for, up to today, they've been looking for those plans that the federal government have for them in the pipelines. Now, I explained to them, I said there are two kinds of injustices you look at in the Niger Delta. The first is the one that the Nigerian country visits on the people of Niger Delta. They were denied our right of existence, our right to own our God-given resources, to solve our difficult terrain, and to develop ourselves in the Committee of States. That is the larger picture. The smaller picture is the inability of people like us, those who are in government, those of us who have been in government and who are still in government, to manage the resources that we managed to squeeze out from the federal government. That's why I classified it to two types of injustice. But I'll leave the inability of the government, the state and local government, to manage the little resources we get from federal government and go to the larger picture which interests you most, because I'm sure, well, the smaller picture also interests you when you talk about transparency and allocation of resources and management of such resources. It does interest you. We'll get to it when we... But let's look at the bigger picture, which interests everybody in the Niger Delta. The bigger picture, I have told you, present this challenge of a weak federal structure or a very poor federal structure where the federal government does anything they want to do with impunity. They don't care. It's as if, to hell, what will you do? We take your oil and so bloody what? And there are laws that protect them. There's a Land Use Act that says anything you find on top of the land or under the land belongs to the federal government. And it includes... Oh, no, that's the Mineral Act. That's the Mineral Act. The Land Use Act is one I enjoy because it says all land belongs to the governor of the state. And since I'm the governor, I like to keep the land. They all have their inhibitions because they make it difficult for people to operate in their own God-given land. Imagine where the governor keeps your land for you. It gives us the power to be able to develop the state all the same, because I'm trying to build a new city now. Imagine if you owned all. It would have been difficult to access those land. Now, when I go to acquire the land for the development of the new city, and I said, can I buy it at commercial price? Some of them go to millions of naira. When they go there, I say, look at the law. The law says that the governor can take his land, though. So better bring down your price so I don't apply the law. Then the man will begin to see how to accommodate my own interest and his own interest. But the Mineral Act actually is even the worst. It includes even there's a Marine Act that tells you that the water up to near your house belongs to the federal government. So you can't even fish unless you're at the mercy of the federal government. So imagine you habiting in the creek. We are peculiar people, the river people. There's no place in Niger Delta that has 3,000 creeks. River State has 3,000 creeks. And people live around there. So imagine you living in your house, and the only source of livelihood is fishing. You have the law stopping you from fishing. You have Shell and all other oil companies polluting the water, killing the fish you want to even fish. Even if the federal government has said, okay, don't worry, won't worry, you can fish. Then if you go to the place to fish, Shell has already killed all the fishes you want to fish. I'm sure our friend who was in Shell before will attest to the fact that there is a lot of pollution going on in the Niger Delta waters because of the activities of the oil company. So both, we're very unfortunate people. Both the federal government and even the oil companies don't care. Nobody cares about us. There's nothing called, the standards that the oil companies operate overseas are not the same standards they operate in Nigeria. And that's because of the weak structure. Not just with the federal structure this time, it's the capacity of the government to implement law. That is a big problem. So you have that to grapple with. Now, all these deniers, all these injustices can only lead to one thing, poverty. You agree? It can only lead to poverty. And poverty stems also from unemployment, lack of the capacity to have the source of livelihood, means of putting food on your table. Now, the struggle for power will now exploit that poverty and unemployment as men who seek power. The means of production in Nigeria, you know, when they say Nigeria is a capitalist country, I laugh. Capitalism deals with production. You can hardly produce in Nigeria. So you have what I call crude form of capitalism, where everybody seems to be running towards the only source of livelihood, government. Everybody wants to be in government. It's the only means. It's the only means of production. What does government produce? Nothing. So for them, what government produces is just money. And everybody wants to be in government. Even these criminals that are busy shooting, they were used by those struggling for power. They were a creation of those politicians like me, struggling for power. They were armed to protect them against the other party or against the other individuals. And at the end of the day, when you finish using them, you abandon them. And I continue to say to people and to government, if government is unable to produce or provide a legal means of livelihood, a legal means of livelihood, the chances are that the man, whether you or me, would find an illegal means of livelihood. It could include gun running, gun bearing, murder, armed robbery, anything, just because you want to live. Both the rich and the poor all want life, right? If the rich is making money from government and they're living with their children, recreating themselves, the poor will die if they make no money. If they are not able to access the state funds, then they will access the state funds or other funds by other means. That has led to what we now refer to as criminality. But true, there is crime going on. Now, these young men who were used, they were not used because, they were not created because they were created to fight for the injustice in Niger Delta State. No. They were a creation of accident. They were created for political purposes. Having solved that political purpose, the politicians don't need them anymore until the next election. These boys now began to form gangs and other groups. They began to do illegal bunkering, because I'm told there's illegal bunkering. From illegal bunkering, they get weapons from those who buy this oil. They get guns. They also buy from other sources. And from there, they grow to robbery and other forms of crime. When it occurred to them, and that again is by accident, they tried kidnapping a white man who works for an oil company. And government panicked. And government paid huge sums of money, bigger than what they get from bunkering. They say, then why are we into bunkering when they can catch a white man and make hundreds of millions of naira? Then they used to pay hundreds of millions of naira. And then 120 million naira is $1 million. Sometimes they get as much as $2 million for carrying one white man. So why would they go into having to bust share pipe to get oil and send to the high sea? Some of them can die in the course of doing that. When all they need to do is wait with guns and catch one white man, and people will negotiate, and they will get $2 or $3 million. So, but don't forget, as I'm talking to you, I hope you're following the trend. The trend is, why are they not enforcing the law? There's impunity in the process. I just want you to have your thought line to follow that line. There is impunity, both on the side of the federal government when it comes to our resources, and on the side of these young men who are criminals. But while you're doing that, don't lose sight of the fact that there were genuine men who started the struggle against injustice in Niger Delta before these young boys emerged. Those boys were academics. They were very serious. They were vanguard. While they were speaking and playing with internet and trying to form youth groups, the other groups emerged who were carrying guns to kidnap people, to do bunkering, to rape, to murder, to do armed robbery, and to do sea piracy. Now, I have left them to address the issue of criminality. So these criminals exist. They have taken over what you can consider the struggle. The intellectual class appears to be at the background now because of the fact that these criminals have taken over. And I told you that the two issues are unemployment and poverty. In 2007, I have been speaker for 8 years. I was speaker 1999 to 2007, May. By the time I went to court, I knew that the former president would come after me. I went on self-exile in Ghana. So I was in Ghana for 10 months. On October 25, 2007, the Supreme Court declared that I was a rightful candidate of PDP and therefore I should be sworn in as the governor of Rivers State. I was sworn in on October 26, 2007. When I came back and got sworn in, it occurred to me that the first thing is law and order. Don't forget that I was once a parliamentarian and I was a Speaker of Parliament for 8 years. Presence of law creates certainty. You know the crime you commit. You know the consequence of your action. So you choose what to do at any particular point in time. If you live in a society, not lawless, when you say lawless, it's a society without laws. This time there are laws, but they're not implemented. Now, if you live in a society where laws are not implemented, it means I can just wake up and kill you and nothing will happen. Most people don't want to live in that society. They will leave that environment. And people began to leave River State in droves to Lagos and Abuja. And our economy, including the oil economy, began to transfer to Lagos. If you ask Shell today what is SNOPCO, they will tell you SNOPCO is their outfit that drills oil on the high sea. They call it offshore. Now, if you drill oil in the offshore, what I ask them, I say, is there any offshore oil in Lagos? The answer is no. We take a helicopter to Niger Delta and drill the oil. So both Shell and all other oil companies, including our people, those who kidnap people, are deliberately moving the oil economy to Lagos. And I fear, because that would be another phase of the struggle. And that one will not be criminal in nature. It will be intellectual and will be more dangerous. That's why they should not allow the oil economy move out of the Niger Delta, because we cannot have the oil, and those enjoying the oil economy will be in Lagos and Abuja. So you can see both the oil companies moving the economy to Lagos, and then you can see our people helping them by kidnapping to move the economy out. And the first solution I thought about in my mind is not to negotiate with any criminal. You don't negotiate with an armed robber. I've asked those who say negotiate with them. Have you ever sat down with an armed robber and said to him, don't rob, take money? And he will take. If he takes, the next time the money finishes, he will do what? He will rob. So the first thing to do is to enforce law and order. The best form of government is a government that recognizes the rule of law, not the rule of man. Because the rule of man means that I can wake up tomorrow and say, I don't like your face, go to jail. But if we are guided by the rule of law, you will ask the court to tell you what crime you've committed that makes the governor say you should go to jail. So I decided that I chose the rule of law, which also implies that even me, I'll be guided by that same law. I cannot wake up to do whatever I will do. So we tried hard to equip the security agencies and make them go after these gentlemen. These gentlemen used to live in Port Harcourt City like every other person, commit their crimes, shoot at anybody inside the same city. But 1 week after I became governor, everybody went to inside the creeks. Because if you stay in your house and commit crime, I'll come to your house. They know we'll find it a bit difficult to maneuver the waters to be able to catch them because there are 3,000 creeks. If you come this way, I wish I had a picture of it, you will see. If you're coming this way, they're escaping from the other way. Once they are able to know you're around, they are out. And the difference is that the military will come with a bigger boat. They have smaller boats that can maneuver the creeks, very tiny creeks, and they're off. So they are in the creeks, but a lot of them have been arrested. And now, I'm not sure that the international press, including the local press, are being fair to us because calm has returned to Port Harcourt City and River State. You can ask. It wasn't the way it was before. In fact, somebody who came from South Africa said to me, then you need rebranding. You need to rebrand the city. I said, why? He said, listen, I come from South Africa. Johannesburg is worse than here. But on the internet and the international press, your city is worse than Johannesburg. What will I do? I can tell you for sure that I have how many contractors that are working in the state capital who are not from Rivers State, and they are foreigners. ROCC is an Israeli company. Homan is a Lebanese company. Gito is an Italian company. There are white men working there. I heard that about 600 British men and women working with Shell up to now, and they're not being kidnapped. Kidnap in River State is no longer the same as it used to be before. Before, it was on a daily basis. Now you rarely hear of it. If you hear of it, maybe two or three times in a month. And I told the public, I didn't say there will be no kidnapping anymore. I said I will reduce it. With time, we may eliminate it completely. But I'm just 1 year. Give me time to eliminate it. But for now, we have reduced it drastically, drastically. In fact, when we clear Port Harcourt, when we try to stop kidnapping from Port Harcourt, they moved to the Ogoni areas. Before I came, the kingpin was arrested in the Ogoni area. And I hear that as soon as we arrested them, they surrendered everybody that was kidnapped in the Ogoni area without any ransom. And why are they finding kidnap difficult? It's because I said I won't pay ransom. Before, when government was paying, if they kidnap you, government will pay like $2 million or $1 million. That's big business. But now if you know you won't make money, why carry a man that you will not make money from? That's what the way it is. But let me go to the conclusion so that, because I can see Jennifer looking at me. The conclusion is, now as a governor, having identified all this, what is the solution? Yes, you've identified that the first solution is law and order. Beyond law and order, does law and order find solution to the root cause of the problem? The answer is no. No matter how much guns you shoot, a man who is hungry will look for a way to find solution to his hunger. Because if he doesn't eat, he will die. If he goes to steal, he may possibly also die. All of them will lead to death. So he will take a risk. Because their chances are that if the system is weak enough, he will steal enough and eat and may not be caught by the system. And he will survive and stay hungry and die. So we think that the thing to do is to find solution to unemployment and poverty. They are very key issues. And the first way to find a solution to unemployment and poverty is development of infrastructures. We have chaotic power solution. We have chaotic power problems. Electricity is a very big problem in Nigeria, and it's a big problem in River State. So we are advancing on that. We believe that by June we should be able to deliver 100 megawatts of power by June. By December this year, we deliver another 75, which will give us 175 megawatts. And there is currently 150 megawatts that was bad and abandoned, which we are fixing. If you aggregate all that, we bring to 300 something megawatts of power. That, we believe, will generate the industrial sector of the economy once we can do that. But key to it is that you must arrest the security situation. If not, nobody will come and invest when the security is the way it is. That's why you see it is a twin approach. Bring down security, grow the economy by infrastructure development. So we're looking at power. We're looking at roads. I've told you here about so many rules that have been done. That's why I did tell Jennifer it's important they come to River State and see for themselves. We're thinking about what you call Beltway. We call it Ring Road. We're building one that will cost us $1 billion because the city is congested. You know, it's an oil city. Everybody's coming to do business. So you need to give them as many rules as possible to be able to transact their business. Time is of essence to a businessman. So we're doing quite a lot of rules. I've called about how many Lebanese contractors that are in there. There is an Israeli company I've called ROCC. There is, Jelos Beja is there. Jelos Beja is doing a flyover and a road. There are so many rules that have been done. But these are not what impact positively on the majority of the poor. It's not. Two key areas that impact on the poor, education and health. Now, the law on education in Nigeria is skewed. Primary education, which is the foundation of education, is the responsibility of the councils. And the councils are not financially equipped to handle it. So what did I do? I'm amending the law. I've already taken over primary education from local government council. It's known in Nigeria. I'm paying the salaries of teachers. When I got in, they couldn't pay anybody's salaries. They couldn't employ teachers. There were no desks in the schools. Roofs were dilapidated. Classrooms, doors broken, windows broken. Children were sitting on the floor. In fact, I'll give an example of one that happened a week or two before I came here. I just saw one primary school. and I drove in. And it was in such a poor situation, I climbed upstairs to see what it was. And I saw one door locked, and I asked the security man to force the door open. They forced it open, and there was a naked man. Meanwhile, in two or three other classrooms, there were children, male and female, studying. Naked, and he ran to his trousers, meaning that that is his house. It's an abandoned classroom, and somebody has taken it over and occupied it. If you look where, in law, there's what they call adverse possession. If you look where that man can be a landlord, if you don't take that. So, what we decided to do is first to take over the payment of salaries of teachers in the primary schools. That's the first thing we did. And it's a total of 868 million naira, which is, how much is that? 1 billion would be like 12 or 16 billion, I mean $16 million. So 868 would be like 10 million, about $10 million, right? That's salaries for primary school teachers, not secondary and not university, because the responsibility of the state government is on that of the secondary education and tertiary education. Primary is the responsibility of councils. But I decided to take all, let it be done as if there is no federal government, there is no state government, local government, just the state government. So I've taken over the payment of primary school teachers. I've taken a step further. I'm constructing new primary schools, 250 primary schools for this year. The first set of 250 primary schools will be concluded in between April and June. They're already constructing. If you visit Port Harcourt, you can come and see for yourself. You don't need to see me. Just go to most primary schools. What we did is 20 primary schools in Port Harcourt City, 20 in Obiabo, 20 in Kana, because these are the three largest local government areas. The rest are 14. And what government used to build before is 6 classroom blocks. That's what government and oil companies used to build before, too. Oil companies would build 6 classroom blocks and call the whole community and donate it to them. We felt that to be good enough. We are building each school. We have the one in Port Harcourt will have 20 classrooms. The ones outside Port Harcourt will have 14 classrooms. So you don't need to be building 6 classroom blocks around the same school when you can build just one of 20 classrooms. So we are constructing in Port Harcourt 20 classrooms, and then in the other local government areas, we are constructing 14 classrooms in each of the buildings. Next year, we'll do another 250 to bring it to a total of 500. Why are we doing that? When I asked to know, a friend of mine who was working in the World Bank, I asked her to resign. She's an Italian. I asked her to resign and come and be my consultant on a lot of fields. She's an economist. When I asked her to do for me a study of the education in Port Harcourt, in River State, she came up and told me that the highest that any government in River State had contributed to education is 0.08 or something. And I said, that's it? She says, last year we did 18% of the budget. This year, because of the economic meltdown, I don't know how we're going to manage it, but we're doing better than 18%. But it's not as expected. We are planning to do 25% of the budget on education. But last year we did 18%. That 18% included the fact that we are rebuilding the university. We're moving them from the small land they're occupying now to a bigger place. 150 hectares of land. And we're building for 60,000 students, which means we're building for the next 20 to 30 to 50 years. That's the tertiary institution, the university. But for the primary education, I've told you, we believe that when she finished her studies, she came up with the conclusion that there are a total of 1,300 primary schools. And I can tell you the school, you will laugh. The one I went and saw, the naked man, there are about 6 structures. In that 6 structures, you have St. Andrew's Primary School 1, that same compound. St. Andrew's Primary School 2 to 8. That's what they called 1,300 school. And then I told her, I said, let me tell you what happened to me. When my cousin was a commissioner for education, the man who became governor before me, is my blood cousin. He was one time commissioner for education. When he was commissioner for education, we used to have 2 primary schools. So he brought 1 primary school as his own contribution to my community from the state government. So it became State School 3, that's the 3rd primary school in my community. When I became a speaker, the head of the primary schools gave my village 1 more primary school, making it State School 4. Meanwhile, my village required only 2 primary schools, only 2. The implication, therefore, as I told her, is that most of the primary schools you're seeing that you refer to as 1,300 are not guided by population needs of the population. So I told her, simple, don't be afraid, don't be afraid. We will not get 1,300. We'll build according to the number of people that require the primary school in the particular location. So on my own, let's deal with 500. If we can't get more money, we'll renovate the rest. So we're dealing with 250 this year, next year 250. That's as it concerns primary schools. And we're going to run free primary education. These primary schools have internet facilities, library, and we're going to buy school uniforms for the children so that parents will stop funding primary education from their pockets. We're not rich. Let us use our God-given wealth in the oil sector, as we're able to get from the federal government, to be able to assist those who live in Port Harcourt and those who own the city and those who own the state. The other aspect is health. I won't go through the hog of education. Let's go to health so that I can sit down and then you ask your questions. The other aspect is health. We're building a total of 150 primary health cares, primary health centers. I'm sure if you watch CNN, you will have seen them. There was this Planet Imperial that interviewed me. You will have seen the health centers. One of the journalists who interviewed me said, in America, this is a hospital. I said, well, to us in Port Harcourt, this is a health center, not a hospital. It has the capacity to do minor surgery and can house about 7 patients for one day. Because don't forget, primary health centers are outpatient facilities. But it has capacity for 7 patients per day. And the implication is that after that day, you are referred to the secondary health institution. And we're building 150. We have a contract with a company that's building 105 for 18 billion naira. It includes equipping the hospital, the health center. And the rest 45 we give to indigenous of the state, local contractors, to see the quality of work that they will do. The day the CNN came there, we visited that health center, unannounced, unplanned, and we saw that they were seeing not less than 150 patients on that day. That's what they saw. You can see the photograph was there when they walked in. So why did we focus on health center? Because we know that most of the reasons that for which patients go to the general hospitals, which is the secondary health institution, is because of ailments that can be handled at the primary healthcare or primary health centers. Headache, malaria, diarrhea, cough. Why should we waste the time of a man who is supposed to be seeing specialist cases? So we're taking that away from the secondary health institution to the primary health institutions. And like I said, 150 should be enough. And each has an ambulance to transfer any serious case to general hospital. We've not done much as it concerns the secondary health institution because we want to see the outcome of our investment in the primary health care. But we are building currently a 1,000-bed hospital at the tertiary level of healthcare. 1,000-bed. It is geared towards medical tourism. It's an 18-story building with its own power. Don't bother about the fact that we don't have enough power. This one will have its own power and will have its own water and everything. The other final part that affects the poor is water. We don't have water anywhere in the city or anywhere in the state. This year, we have partnered with an Indian company that will bring its own fund and do our water, reticulate the water, and collect its own revenue. After that, then the state government will do the rural water scheme. I'm sure that I've talked too much. I will allow you to ask the questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Governor. Very comprehensive talk, and I think really gave us an idea of your priorities. I think we'll open it up for questions. We'll take a few at a time, if you don't mind, because we don't have that much time. We have about 30 minutes. Any takers out there? The lady, yes, you, not with the pencil, or we'll get to you eventually. Again, I don't have my glasses.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you, Governor, for those remarks. My name is Alexandra Gillies from the University of Cambridge, and I had two questions. First is, with the drop in oil prices, I imagine your budgetary allocations are going to be a lot lower this year than they were last year and the year before. And I'm wondering how that's going to affect the spending plans that you mentioned in infrastructure and health and education, and also whether you were able to save any of the very high allocations you received last year and the year before. And the second question is, I'm a bit confused about how the mandate of the new Ministry of the Niger Delta relates to the role of the state governments. So I'm curious if you're worried about duplication of efforts and how what the discussions are around who's going to do what. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the lady right in front of her. Oh, that's Deirdre. I really can't see a thing. I'm sorry.
Lady with the pencil. My name is Deirdre LePin from the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thank you, Governor, very much for your remarks. You mentioned that there are two big issues. One is unemployment, and the other one is poverty. And then when you spoke about poverty, you emphasized the need for infrastructure. For a long time, we've been talking a bit about how we can put these unemployed youth to work. And it would seem that if there's a large need for infrastructure, this would be a major opportunity to create jobs. As you are probably aware, our current president has been thinking about a similar program here in the United States, which revives an old idea from the 1930s, from the Roosevelt era. And so I was wondering if this is something that you think the River State could implement.
Yes. Microphone's coming. Here's the mic.
Samuel Adeniyi-John from HHS. Two things, quickly. One, historical perspective. I remember reading Silvano Cucchi's book on King Jaja and the Niger Delta. And then we were dealing with palm oil. And some of the issues are the same, you know. The fact that, you know, a lot of outsiders are coming and you know, getting your resources and going away. So I would like to hear your perspective on that. That the fact that historically this whole issue actually preceded this all problem. My question then is on public-private partnerships. I think there's a great opportunity here for, you're talking of what the government is going to do, that's the public. But a lot of these oil companies, I remember I was part of some discussions with Saad Tobi I mentioned to you and the former governor on the fact that, you know, some of the oil companies were willing to help develop these health centers. In fact, they claimed they had actually built some health centers before that had gotten dilapidated. So what don't you think the opportunities for good public-private partnerships to help, especially in the health area?
Maybe we can stop there. I wanted to add one more question, which was the relationship with the federal government. Because in a lot of what you're describing sounds like you've, aside from the allocation, you've kind of planned without factoring them in, taking over, you know, primary school from the local authorities, but also building universities. Does that fall to the federal government? On security as well, how does that work? And how are you pressing the federal government to take up its federal responsibilities on that? Or maybe I'm wrong on when I'm hearing you. Should we start there? We had the drop in oil prices and what that will mean for...
I give an example. Last year, we were receiving 20 billion naira per month, which is quite huge. I told you it's about, at 120, how would that be? About nearly $200 to $300 million per month. It's come down to 14 billion naira this year. So this month, by the time I go home, I'll be seeing 14 billion naira. As if I knew that we'll run into crisis, I saved a total of 104 billion naira. That's why I saved from last year, because you talked about savings. Now, our budget this year is bigger than our budget for last year. And that's because we saved money. Because if you look at the budget, actually, what we are getting this year from federal government will be 230-something billion naira. Last year, we got over 366 billion naira from federal government. But this year, we're getting about 200-something billion naira. So why the increase? Two factors. First is that, like somebody said, he is praying that this oil price should not rise so that Nigerians will become responsible. His argument is that, take us for instance, once we saw that we are not getting, we will not be getting enough money from the federal government this year, we later realized that that's what is called IGR, internally generated revenue, which you call tax. So when we have to, these people, they should be taking their money, this in free. We will not tax everything that everybody's buying or eating. Or we're even getting to roads, we'll tax the roads very soon. But let's go to areas where the big men spend their money and get the taxes. So our IGR has risen from this last year, we got 33 billion. This year, we're getting 99 billion naira from IGR. So then plus the 104 billion naira that we have saved. That's why you have a budget higher than last year's budget. But in terms of income from the federal government, it has reduced drastically. So will it affect education? It won't affect primary education. No, I won't let that happen. It may affect the tertiary institution because the River State University of Science and Technology is located somewhere, and I was planning to move them. So the best I can do this year is infrastructural development while I slow down on the construction of accommodation, classrooms, and all. I'll slow down on that and wait and see what happens next year. So, yes, it will affect education, but only at the tertiary level. Health. It may affect the secondary health institutions because our plan this year was once we complete the health centers, we'll now go and focus on the secondary health institutions. And there's quite a lot of them that require innovation. We are planning not to renovate, we are planning to reconstruct. If we are going to do 23 this year, we have almost reduced it to only 3. Instead of 23, we'll likely be doing just 3 that will act as reference centers. People from all over the state can just take in their patients there and they are seen. But in the city, we're already building 3 already. And that was because we started it before this economic crisis. So we'll complete it all the same. We'll complete the 3 we're building the city, equip it for people who will come to the city. But outside the city, we won't go beyond the 3 we think we should construct this year, or reconstruct or renovate. That's what will happen on that case. You talked about the Ministry of Niger Delta and conflict. Everybody says that in law, there'll be conflict. But what we plan to do is the ministry will meet with all the governors, and we'll make sure that we harmonize. Currently, there's no harmonization. You will go to a community, there's a water project by Niger Delta Development Commission, which is not working. There's a state government water project, completed, not working. There is one by which other group that comes there? Maybe Niger Delta Basin Development Authority, not working. Then maybe one of these oil companies, either Shell, will come and put their own, not working. The 4 of them are there. None is bringing out water, but they're all called water project. So what we've agreed this year with the minister is to sit and say to them, like I've told them, I said, don't bother about rural electrification because I've already awarded a contract that all the remaining 300 communities in my state should all be given power. Whether they have power or not is immaterial to me. Hook them up to the national grid. Anytime the federal government supplies power, let them get power. But if they can wait, anytime we complete our power project, then they can have our own power. But for now, let's assume that the federal government power project is working. If it's working, let it be that they are linked to the national grid. And anytime that is working, they will have power. If we complete our own, we link them to our own project. If you listen to me, Ma, when I was speaking, I said that I found that one of the solutions to unemployment and poverty would be massive infrastructural development. And I named that a lot of roads. You can ask any of those you know in Port Harcourt. A lot of roads are being constructed, including the road where Shell is located. Now, the Old Aba Road is being constructed by a company called Xerox. It's a Lebanese firm. We're expanding the roads with 2 to 3 meters of median, with street lights and all that. So a lot of roads in Port Harcourt are being reconstructed and people are being employed. The problem is not now that you're constructing. The problem is that most of the employment that emanates from infrastructure development end after the infrastructure has been developed. So you still have them remaining unemployed. But the problem we have with employment in River State is that some of them are unemployable because of what I said, that education is not just about infrastructural development in education. It's also about affordable and accessible education. Let there be school close to where you are and let everybody be able to afford that school. So you have these children who are shooting guns, not exceeding primary three in primary school. So how do you employ that kind of person beyond construction work? That's the problem we have with that. But we're looking at it because of the issue of skills acquisition and farming. The River State Sustainable Development Agency is an agency we funded last year up to the tune of 13 billion naira. And they have created a farm called a replication of the Songhai Farm in the Republic of Benin, where they have taken 130 or 13 farmers to go to be trained at Benin Republic, and they will own the farm in River State in Thai local government area. On the issue of PPP, you can't do PPP with oil companies. They won't agree. PPP has an implication of commercial viability, each party bringing its own resources. No, these oil companies will tell you they're here to do business of making money through oil, and they pay their taxes to federal government. It's the responsibility of the state and federal government and local government to develop areas. But we are doing PPP. I had two meetings in America as I came in. One is, for the past 1 year, I've been chasing investors on the ring road. Not because we can't do the ring road, but because we want to tow the ring road. And government is a poor manager of business. So let somebody bring money. And we've got an American outfit that is trying to raise $600 million while we bring the $400 million. And they will own the road. They will tow it over 25 years and make back their money. We are doing a PPP on monorail. That's the last meeting I had in America here too, monorail. And that's a total of, there's a $132 million. Actually, the Commit America is a blessing because we are talking with a European company that was asking for 188 million euros. And so before I came, in advance, we sent all the details to this American company and the price came down to $132 million. So imagine the gap. It's double the price, $132 million versus $188 million. I simply called the other company this afternoon and say, even though we've signed these documents, we need to meet again. Because for me, this is cheaper. Though the company in Europe is bringing 80% of the funds, but we'll give them bridge financing first, for the first phase. Now, I'm telling them, yes, you're bringing 80% of the fund, but this is cheaper. So we can, and the American company say, well, we'll look at the Exim Bank. Let's see if the Exim Bank will be willing to fund the technology while you and you as government can fund the civil works and the construction of stations. But that was one of the meetings we had here, and that's also PPP. The issue of foreigners and our wealth, no matter what you do, we're a minority. You cannot shy away from that. The bigger people will continue to take away the wealth. All we are saying is that we'll also be allowed to have a bite. Right? That's all we're saying. We're not saying they shouldn't continue to bite it. We're saying, please, if you take out of 24 hours, if you take like 18, give us the remaining 6 hours to take a bite. Maybe we'll even bite more than you that had 18 hours. On the issue of security and the federal responsibility, what I decided to do as a governor on the issue of federal responsibility is to assume that nobody has a responsibility in the state outside me. Because at the end of the day, nobody's able to distinguish between the local government and the federal government. All they see is the governor. The governor is their president, is their local government chairman, is their everything. If a man who by nature or by circumstance may not be able to impregnate his wife, he takes it out on the governor. Poor health facilities, if you go to the hospitals, no water. Even when he's talking about the University of Port Harcourt Teaching Hospital that belongs to the federal government, is the governor. So I decided, in fact, there's a road called the East-West Road. It takes you from the east to the western part of Nigeria. It belongs to the federal government. It's so bad But when people are driving past, I hear them because I drive. I don't. Most times I just tell the security man to leave me alone. Just follow me with three cars. That's all I want. No convoy, no siren. I go into this bad road and you hear them abusing this useless government. They don't want to. In fact, it was so bad recently that I asked the commissioner for works to award the contract, which he has done for 233 million naira to fix, just to patch, repair the road temporarily until when they're able to fix it. But it's a major road that the federal government wants to do now. They want to do it through the Ministry of Niger Delta. But I'm fixing it up. So it's difficult to say, yes, we know there are responsibilities, but if you wait, the people are not waiting for the federal government. You have to do it. The same in security. I did the same in the area of security. Thank you.
Great. I will take another round. I did want to, before I forget and let people start heading up, Ojo Madueke, the foreign minister of Nigeria, will be here tomorrow beginning at 10:30, from 10:30 to noon, and you're all most welcome to come. Please let us know if you're coming. You can email Dave Hennick. So sorry for that interruption, but just get that advertisement in. The gentleman here, and then over there, and then in the way back. Oh, over here, okay. Oh, gosh, okay, yeah.
Ask for your audience, what is it?
Okay, there.
Thank you very much. I'm Philip Bosco, the CEO of Active Power Systems from the state of Maryland. My question for Your Excellency is, what is the pathway to bringing the gas flaring to an end? But more importantly, how can that wasted flaring be used for free electricity for your local villages and the free water that is wasted on each and every well site that could be recycled using filters and the UV lighting to provide free electricity and free water to your local villages?
Thanks for that. What do we say? Over here first, and then in the back, and then over here.
Hi, I'm Joe Siegel with the National Defense University. I wanted to follow up on Jennifer's question about security. The way you described it, it sounded like you were able to flip a switch and enforce law and order, and you achieved remarkable results. If you could explain a little bit more, did you use the police? Were there military forces that you were...
You're being unfair. They don't discuss security in this kind of place now. if we discuss the security of the inauguration, would anybody have gone there? If you ask me to say whether there's an improvement, I can discuss whether there's an improvement or not. But to tell you what we applied, who we saw, what we did, okay, we went to native doctors.
Okay. I guess the flip side of that is you talked about the underlying causes being poverty and unemployment, and you've done a lot to generate employment. Have you seen that have an effect?
Oh, yeah.
Or has the fact that the incentives for the abductions are so high that it really hasn't had much of an impact at all?
Thank you, Joe. And then in the way back. Yeah, I'm coming over here next time. We still got time. We still have time.
Thank you, Governor. Eric Gutchess from Human Rights Watch. You alluded to in your comments that the federal allocations you've received in the last year, approximately $3 billion, which exceeds that any state governor has received in the history of the Federation, and also that of most the central government budgets of most central governments in West Africa. My question for you, when it comes to issues of corruption, in October, your chief of staff was arrested and indicted for embezzling some 3 billion naira in state funds. Specifically, my question, though, on that is, why up until now have you been unwilling to publish the state expenditure reports as well as require the local governments within River State to publish the budgets and expenditure reports? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's get over here. Okay, in the far left corner.
Well, I thought you would have allowed me to answer this straight, then we'll go back.
Okay. Well, we'll come to you next.
Let me start with the issue of corruption. I thought you would have congratulated me for being very transparent. You can ask Nigeria. Every 3 months, I call Riversipo to a stakeholders meeting, and I beam it live, not edited. Gentlemen, good morning. I have received XYZ amount this month. I spent XYZ amount this month. The following funds are Bank A, Bank B, Bank C. The first in the history of Nigeria. But don't forget that the issue of corruption in Nigeria is also political. That's where I want to go, because the matter is in court. I don't want to go beyond that. But just know that I am the first and the only governor that comes. You can watch it in America. I use AIT that is on satellite. It's watched all over. People call me after I finish. The first time I tried to do it, the first time my people panicked. They had an all-night meeting. My press advisor is here. Say, oh, can we do a delayed transmission? I said, no. Live. No delayed transmission. Live. Oh, they will embarrass us. Let them embarrass us. So that everybody will know. The last one I did, you know what I did? I asked all commissioners to come to the place. They came. Commissioner for this, come. I gave you such amount of money for this month. Tell the public how you spend the money. Because I'm the governor, I have no money. My job is to send the money to your office. You apply. The budget says XYZ. Release XYZ budget to me. That's what the law says. And I say, approved. So you tell the public how you spend the money. There was no pre-information. Everybody was panicking. Live. It wasn't delayed transmission. It wasn't reported. It was live. And people were asking questions just like you're asking now. When the issue of corruption comes, that's why, you know, for it to still be on air, you should know that there must be a reason why everything up to now is still on air. I'm alluding to something. For it to still be on air, that, oh, it's chief of staff. Now they've left my chief of staff, so, oh, they're probing me. And I say, for more than how many months, you've tried to find out whether I even own a house. My wife is here. Not a house to live. Public officer, 8 years as speaker, 1 year, 3 months as governor, I don't have a private house where I can call my own. I thought you had said you're a bit transparent. I may not be too transparent. Now, the gentleman who talked about security, I've answered you. The security is a very sensitive issue. You don't tell the world how you secure them. Because if you tell a thief I'm coming, then he won't be where you're coming to. But we are doing our best. The situation has changed in Niger Delta. You can see it. You can see that people now coming. We have some investors coming from South Africa. They are building hotels. There's one coming for aloe vera mineral plant. So many things are happening. It wasn't so when I came. First, there was a curfew. 4 p.m., people are going to bed. In fact, there was a joke when I lifted the curfew that I got. The joke was that, this curfew was baby-making period. Husbands were staying at home. Governor Meji has come now. Husbands are now out of the houses. That was a joke. But it gave people their voice. People couldn't speak, because if you spoke, the voice would meet in your house, and you're a dead man. But when I came, people even abuse me now. Then they couldn't abuse me, because me, I could say, these boys are coming after you. Now there's a little bit of freedom on the street. When I came, there was no light nightlife, no nightclubs, and Port Harcourt was, ask anybody in the country, it was one city that you would dance from 8 p.m. to the next morning. People went to work, because Thursday nights were called ladies' night. People went to work from nightclub on Thursday night. Friday morning, they went to work and then go home after work and come back in the night. But by the time this thing started, nightclubs were closed. As I'm talking to you now, nightclubs are back. People go 2, 3 a.m., go and sleep. It's not back to 6 a.m. as they used to do, but gradually to get to 6 a.m.
Productivity is down, but I'm just kidding.
The gas flaring is a federal issue. It's not a state government issue. It's a federal government issue. Well, what will we do? That's the point. We're paying the price as far as the oil is concerned. That's the point. We're paying the price. If you're talking about just gas flaring. People who don't have water used to drink rainwater. Now you can't. It's acidic. You drink, you die. So we know that. Even the gas we are using for the gas turbine that we're building, we're paying. That is not River State government that they gave. Niger Delta Development Commission is a federal agency. So we are saying, that's why I made an allusion that it's like a very big man with tiny legs. We are saying that these sites can be reduced to flesh up the legs, and we are the legs. That's what we are saying.
I know.
We're not allowed by law. You can only look like this.
No squat on it.
Okay, ma'am.
Okay. All right. We promised over here. We'll go.
All right.
You decide among yourselves.
All right. Good day. My name is Dr. Dekil Marvin. I'm a reverse indigent, of course, well known to the governor as well. I have three questions, three things to discuss. First is the issue to do with unemployment. I think this is the bane of most of the problems we have in River State. If we want to look at it, the previous 8 years, I don't remember any massive recruitment of Rivers people, even into the state civil service. Currently, I don't know if we are on any such program, but basically we need to generate employment opportunities. I know the government cannot do this alone. And of course, there are very many companies outside of Nigeria, in the UK, in the US, very willing to partner on different projects which can generate employment. I take a case of our waste management problems. There are companies willing to bring their facilities into Port Harcourt, probably pay up to 50% or more of the costs, just to convert the huge waste deposit into some sort of manure. Better still, there are also technology that can convert this into electricity, which is one of the issues we're talking about. Again, there is the problem that has to do with facilities. I know you've talked about developing roads and all of that. And like you stated, these are only short-term employment opportunities.
No, just to ask you, do you go home?
Of course I do.
Okay. Don't laugh. Did you see any of these things, infrastructures that are being discussed here?
Did I see
any of these infrastructures that are being discussed?
Of course here? I did. And okay. one of them is this question to do with the flyovers we have. There is one which is there in Rumola. It's a single lane. And no, especially when you come in with...
That one wasn't built by me.
I know. But the point is
I'm
that...
I'm talking about the current ones we are building.
Exactly.
We are doing three. Two are already under construction. The third one is being mapped out for construction.
So. That's great.
And they're not one lane. That one was done by federal military government. This one that I'm talking about was done is being done by my government.
That's great. This single lane flyover, are we going to do something about it? Because it's actually a source of trouble for commuters and even embarrassment to those of us who bring in foreign friends. Thank you.
Okay, the lady here, and then we'll go to the back, and then we'll come back up front. Okay, center. You can.
My name is Comfort Usukuma from New York. Your Excellency, your openness and transparency and your adherence to rule of law is never in question. Some of us have been following your performance, and those of us who knew what it was previously are very pleased with the work you've done. I just want to say thank you for the work you're doing. However, you raised a very important issue when you spoke about the way the state is being perceived at international level. I have a friend who just came back from home. He's based in UK, and he emailed everyone about how improved the facilities are, the security, and how good the roads are, and everything that you're doing. Everyone is so pleased about that. However, what are you going to do to make sure that internationally, at that international level, people are fully aware that security is no longer a massive issue as it was a year ago? This is crucial, especially if you're looking at investment in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. In the far back, and then we'll come to the center.
There was somebody here that was.
Thank you very much. Roman Spock from National Democratic Institute. I have a two-part question. First one, Governor, how would you characterize your relationship since you're a long-time parliamentarian, with the state assembly and also with the local councils, and how would you view their role in your sort of efforts to improve development in the state? Because after all, as you mentioned yourself, Governor can't do everything himself, but everybody's looking toward you. So how would you characterize your relationship with other institutions within the state? Also, you mentioned various sort of ambitious plans to build hundreds of health centers and also new schools. Have you had any luck recruiting teachers and also recruiting medical staff? And how would you characterize those efforts? Thank you.
Thanks, Roman. Good question. The gentleman here, did you have your hand up? Or, and then we'll go back? Okay, we'll take these two.
I was going to ask about the focus on infrastructure.
Can you identify?
Okay, my name is Bola Onolapo. From my name, you can see I'm from River State. No, that's a joke. But, I want to, your presentation dealt a lot on the infrastructure components of your intervention in various sectors, especially education. And I was going to ask about the issue of the softer side of the sector, the issue of improving enrollment levels of the pupils in school, giving them quality delivery of the education, and having access to other softer components like computers or textbooks and stuff that they need to really have the quality delivery of the education itself. Then the second part of it is the issue of the aspect of maintenance of this infrastructure, especially you quite mentioned the fact that when you go to villages, you see malfunctioning projects, water projects and stuff like that. And we know that Nigeria has a problem of maintaining infrastructure beyond the particular time period. So what are you doing about the maintenance of this infrastructure, even the educational infrastructure, the health infrastructure and the roads and other things that you are doing? Then the last part is that the world is moving towards the age whereby the extraction of mineral resources might not play a very important role in the very near future. The government here is emphasizing the alternative energy, efficient use of energy, and other things like that. Now, and when these things come into play, how do you see the future of a place like River State that is so dependent on revenue from oil in its planning, given the fact that there are other alternatives and that could be used to develop the state? What is the plan for the future of the state looking in the next 10 years when oil might not be so prominent again?
Thank you. My name is Innocent Akani, and Governor, I'm really impressed. You're very expressive, and my concern is I'm in the medical field. I was going home some time ago. I was going with a drug called Xalatan. And unfortunately, you have to put this in the fridge. There's no light. What is going to be your legacy when you leave? And is there any way you can help people from River State to help themselves? We don't need the government. Right now, I'm from River State. Unfortunately, there's no middle class. And there's no way you can build anything without the middle class. If you like, bring all the companies from America, from Europe, everywhere, but we need the middle class. Can you give us electricity? Make it a point of duty that will be your legacy. If you can promise us that, I'll be very happy, so that we can help ourselves. We don't need the government.
I tried to start with the last questions. I asked if you're from River State, because you should have seen that there's a deliberate effort at developing the middle class in River State. Because I told you, I'm not a governor from the rich class. My father was a very poor man. He died struggling to make me a better Nigerian. And he taught me the sense of honesty and transparency. First, honesty. If you're from Rivers, you will know that I'm known. If anybody talks about me, if anybody says he likes me, it's only for one reason. That I mean my word when I say it. When I say I will see you, I will certainly see you. If you've been to River State recently, you will see that I've demolished a lot of houses, right? Or if your relations are there, they will be sending you emails, depending on where you're coming from. When we are demolishing houses in the areas of the poor people, they were saying, good governor. If you go to the street, you can see from beginning to the end. When we go to the rich class, they say, wicked man. They will ask you, has Hurricane Amechi visited you? What else did they call it? The governor remove. Because the agents will come and say, they mark on your house X, then they write remove. 7 days after, according to the law, if you don't remove, we'll come and remove it for you about getting this. We are dead serious about governance. And I've said it to Nigerians, I'm not among those seeking for a second term. And I've told Nigerians, if I run a second term, I'm compelled by my supporters. When I say supporters, politicians, who would want me to stay there. If not, I'm almost getting exhausted. The problems are many, they're myriad. And they're not easy for somebody like me to be part of the process of finding a solution to it. I have friends who fear for my life, not because of Ateke, because I'm a bit... Let's not go to me. Let's go to the questions you asked. The issue of middle class is key to me as a governor. The first step to it is to ask who constitutes the middle class. And if you answer the question of who constitutes the middle class, you have to ask, how do you arm them? That's why I told you, if you listen to me very well, or maybe to you, I said this last year we took 300 students to UK and Canada to study on special fields. This year, we'll repeat the same 300. Next year, the same 300 until I leave office. If I ever do 8 years, I'll be doing that same 300 until I leave office. When they do come back, you know Rizom Palm? Rizom Palm is 16,000 hectares of oil palm estate that is wasting. Wasting. Now, what they were expecting for me to do is to come as governor of Rivers State. How much do you require to reestablish this farm? They say bring 500 million naira, and I bring it for them to reestablish the farm. I've said no. I've got investors from South Africa who will come back to that farm and reestablish the farm, employ our people. It used to employ 5,000 persons before. Now I'm sure it will go beyond that because already it's been overtaken by forests, grasses, trees. To get it back to what it used to be alone will take more than 5,000 personnel. So we're getting back that. To put it in place. Electricity, if you listen to me, I said we are doing 100 megawatts of power in Port Harcourt at Transamade. You can visit, you see they're working. They were working until kidnappers kidnapped Jealous Veja staff and everybody ran away. All the foreigners from Italy and France ran away. We've been appealing to them to come back. Some Nigerian engineers are already working and they promised us that they'll complete it before June. They actually told me April, but I tell people June, so to stay on the safe side. And by December, they told me they will have completed the remaining 75 megawatts. If you combine that with the 150 at Omoku, which is bad, it's producing 60 now, but we tend to get it back to 150 or 100 at least, then you'll be having nearly 300 megawatts of power. The requirement of Port Harcourt in terms of power is 250. They say, engineers say this is suppressed demand. Okay, give and take. If the demand increases because of existence of power, now it goes to 300. So we'll have power in Port Harcourt. We are planning to construct another 300 megawatts of power in the new city. In fact, I told the lady I appointed as a special administrator of the new city to focus on power while she is doing the engineering design of the infrastructures so that we can deliver the power in 1 year. That's what I told her. So if you do that 300 plus the 350 we are doing, you're talking about 650. Our requirement of the whole state won't be in excess of 400 megawatts. It's what you should ask is what I tell the people. Ask what is happening to your money. If we are conscious of the fact that people are asking about their money, then we will deliver on our promises. Even though I didn't make any promise to anybody because I wasn't campaigning. But in course of my discussions as a governor, I've been making a lot of promises to people that we'll do this. So we'll deliver on power. The maintenance of these infrastructures, including the power, including the education, the schools we are building, and the health centers, a big problem. If you listen to this, I'm coming to that. If you listen to the CNN, that's what CNN said when they looked at all the infrastructures I was constructing. The man in his listening said, "Well, it's not in Africa. It's not all about infrastructures alone. Even though some people don't build it, but it's about maintenance." And he asked me that question, and I said, "I will outsource maintenance." Because if you give maintenance to people, they may not be able to maintain these infrastructures. In fact, I don't know about management of the resources. So I think that the solution, I've been trying to convince the Executive Council that we should outsource maintenance, no matter the cost, so that these people will run the facility by themselves and maintain the infrastructures. So we'll do that as far as it concerns education, and we'll do that as far as it concerns the health facilities. That we will do. What is key is very key, more important than even the construction of the infrastructures, is the employment of teachers and medical personnel. In fact, there was one executive council meeting that we had crisis. Not crisis, where we had a lot of disagreement. The commissioner for health came forward and said, for each health center, I need nearly about 8 doctors or something like that. Or 6 doctors. And I said, look at this man. Do you know how much it costs to pay a doctor? And I will employ 6 per health center, multiply it by 150. The money of the state will finish. I will not. I'm inheriting health centers that were bungalows, people's private houses. I'm demolishing and building, story building, beautiful health center. I will employ not more than 2 doctors. And that should service any health center. That's what I told him. I said, start from the fact that there were no doctors at all. None, just a nurse, a midwife that will see a patient who is not a pregnant patient and prescribe drugs and you take, and they were not dying. Now I have come, I have built a better health center, and I say I will give you 2 doctors. One should work from morning till evening, the other one should work from evening till morning. Let them learn to do that. So we are going to employ, we've told him he's working towards that, of the employment of not just doctors, other medical personnel. I've told him I won't exceed 8. Everybody put together, 2 doctors and other personnel per health center. I won't exceed that because I'm paying. Teachers, I will employ teachers both in the primary, secondary, and university. You can ask, if you're from River City, you can ask the VC of the university. That shocked all of them. I drove straight to the university one day. I said, I want to meet with all the teachers in the school. They came. I said, put all the non-academic staff. They all came to the meeting. I said, fine. Now I'm announcing a scholarship program. Anybody who wants to go overseas to study PhD, and at the end of the day, when you graduate, you come and teach here, raise your hand. Nobody raised, but they say they are interested. You're interested? Apply to your VC. Let him come to me. I will approve and pay his scholarship to go and do a PhD. When you graduate, you come back and teach in university. That's what we're working out now. That's one scheme. The next scheme is this one I told you. This, out of these 300 students, most of them are undergraduates. Some are postgraduates. If you go, when you come back, you teach in university. The third and final scheme is that we are employing lecturers from any university, and we think we should pay higher than any other university so that they can come. You can ask anybody in River State, when we came, there were not up to 10 is even an overstatement, of recognized, not professors, the departments. Yes, they were not accredited. They were disaccredited. And when we came, they told me what was the problem, that they were coming again in 6 months. So the first step I took was to dissolve the council. So what are people doing here when all the courses are not recognized by law? After that, I removed the vice-chancellor of the university. I appointed a new vice-chancellor who was then a rector of a polytechnic that was doing well. I called him one day. He came. He rushed. The governor wants to see me. I said, what do you think? How would you feel if I made the vice-chancellor of the university? He said, no, sir. I'm comfortable where I am. I said, you're comfortable? He said, yes. He said, see me the next morning. He came. So as he came, I dressed up. I came down. How are you? He said, fine. You don't want to go to the university? He said, yes. Give me your decision later. Go back to your old university where you came from. It's okay, sir. Okay, sir, I will go. Because anybody I spoke to about how to revive that university called his name. And now he has turned the university around. All the courses in the university have been accredited. Now, even though we spent about 4 billion naira because we had to employ more teachers, we had to get equipment, we had to build labs, equip the labs, hostels, classrooms. We did a lot of things in that university. That's the university that we're moving to the new site when we finish construction. So we're doing quite a lot in that area. Finally, there's somebody who asked me the question of the relationship between the State Assembly and Council and the Governor of River State. As a former speaker, I cherish the independence of the legislature. When I was a governor, and when I was a speaker, we would have passed the budget by now, the appropriation law. But since December till now, our appropriation law has not been passed. You know why it has not been passed? Because I told them, you have your freedom. For the first time, they are not asking questions. No, the governor cannot fund a new city with 50 billion naira. It's too high when people lack water. They're not asking. Before, we don't ask. Just 3 days, the budget is out, and the governor carries on. Because if you ask, the next day, the party will come and see you. The governor says people are harassing him. Now, I'm telling them, harass me. Anyway, you don't want in the budget, tell the state why you don't want it. Or if you want me to come and defend it, I'll defend it. Up to now, they're debating the appropriation law. That's because I'm insisting on the independence of the legislature. Councils, the same. The law says is the local government, is the assembly that will manage them. I've told them, I'm saving 868 million naira for you. What are you doing with it? Because I'm not getting an answer. Anytime, if you follow the process of our last appropriation, we went community by community, town hall meetings, to ask what do you want us to put in the budget. Any community I went to, I say, ask your chairman, the council chairman, I'm saving him 868 million naira. What is he doing with that money? Because I want the people to be able to ask that same question they're asking me. So I'm announcing it everywhere I go, and it's panicking and causing some confusion in the local government areas. So for me, independence of the states, I've told them, you have your freedom, just as I have my freedom. If anybody comes to take my own power, I will take it back from him and put it in my pocket. Because that's what the law says. Everybody has his own limits of power. That's what the Constitution says. Thank you. It was a wonderful audience.
Thank you, Governor, very much. I just want to thank you on behalf of all of us, and you're most welcome to come back and tell us of your progress over time.